Nice to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here, and time to take a look at the wonderful world of Wisconsin wildlife. Scott Craven, UW Extension wildlife ecologist, our guest today. Normally, I'm looking at his smiling face from across the microphone, but today he is broadcasting from the Kemp Research Station in Northwoods, Wisconsin. And Scott, welcome to the program.
Hi, Larry.
Nice to have you back, of course.
And, always nice.
And you're at Kemp, and talk a little bit about the wildlife situation there in the north.
Well, first of all, it's a glorious day here in the Northwoods. As our northern listeners know, it appears that the front has moved through, and it's blue sky, sunshine, and cool temperatures. Very pleasant, so I'm happy to be here. I just drove up this morning. Things here at Kemp, maybe I should say a little bit about what Kemp is first.
Yes, that'd be
good. So folks know where I am. Kemp Natural Resources Station is part of the university's UW-Madison campus's Ag Research Station system. And for folks who drive around the state a bit and see the various farms with the Wisconsin state-shaped sign out front that says University of Wisconsin Research Station, Kemp is one of those facilities. But Kemp's mission differs in that we produce no commodities here, but rather the focus of Kemp Station is all on natural resources, research, education, and outreach programming. And it's a wonderful facility located on the shores of Lake Tomahawk, and all sorts of neat things going on here.
It's a wonderful place.
It is a great place. There are folks here now working on everything from flying squirrels to musky spawning habitat to lakeshore restoration, resampling some of the famous botanist John Curtis's old sample plots from many years ago, all sorts of things like that. And from what I can see, wildlife populations are doing very well, weren't subjected to the flooding we saw in the south, and things look pretty good up here.
That's great. What about the flooding in the south? Do you think it had much of an impact on nesting bird and other wildlife populations?
You know, I really don't, Larry. When you look at the landscape from the air, and as I look driving up today, with still some fields flooded and some rivers still, you know, just getting back in their banks, it was still a relatively small proportion of the overall landscape that was underwater or directly impacted by floodwaters. And most larger mammals, from say squirrel size up, and most birds are of course mobile enough to get out of the way. The kinds of things that may have had some difficulties are some of the small mammals. Some of the turtle nesting was going on. But a lot of bird nesting was already taken care of. Waterfowl, for example, had for the most part hatched.
Yeah.
And now all of this water around is unbelievable brood-rearing habitat for waterfowl. So other than some nests that may have been destroyed, and waterfowl are prone to re-nest anyway if they lose a nest, It shouldn't be a problem for waterfowl resources, and might even be a net gain. Certainly some turtle nests were probably flooded out. Right after the flood, some of our frogs were singing again as if they thought it was the spring floods again. So, again, there'll be plenty of water to keep those tadpoles alive and ready to metamorphose in late summer. I'm sure a few things were swept away, but for the most part, I don't think it was a huge problem for wildlife.
Excellent. Well, let's give our listeners a chance to join in. If you have a question for Scott, give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. I almost gave the calling all pets number here. 1-800-642-1234. If you're in the Madison area, reach us at 263-1890, 263-1890. Give us a call. We'll be glad to get you on the air. And Jan in Madison's on with a question. Hi, Jan.
Hi, Larry. Hi, Scott.
I would
like to know what Scott knows about the cougar that was first sighted, or somehow they got DNA from it in a barn near Milton, mm-hmm. and it was subsequently killed north of Chicago somewhere.
Well, there's a very... You've summarized the story pretty effectively, actually. The cougar that was seen by a farmer outside Milton back in early winter, they did find a DNA sample. It was from a droplet of blood as they were trailing the animal. And so they had the genetic makeup of that animal. And then there were various sightings and records of a cougar, who knows what one, at various places throughout southeastern Wisconsin and ultimately into northeastern Illinois, and ultimately to the cougar that was killed by police in suburban Chicago. And when the DNA testing on that animal was done, lo and behold, it was the same cougar. And the genetics suggested that it was an animal with affiliations to Dakota populations. So it's quite possible that it was an animal that wandered, as they sometimes do, across literally hundreds of miles, if not a thousand, to make it from the Dakotas into Wisconsin and ultimately meet the unfortunate fate that it met outside Chicago. So for a lot of reasons, it was an interesting find. First, it was genetic documentation that, yes, there was, in fact, a valid cougar sighting in Wisconsin. And then ultimately to link it to the one in Chicago was pretty neat. Unfortunate for that animal, but you know, it's generated a lot of interest in cougars again. The DNR has formulated a kind of a scientific study and management group on cougars. There's a website now where you can find the stories related to this animal and lots of other cougar information. And that's about the long and short of it.
Yeah, where's that on the DNR website?
I think if you go to the DNR website, Larry, and do some looking around, especially within endangered resources, you can link up to the cougar information.
All right. Jan, thank you very much for calling. Todd and Holman, it's your turn. Hi, Todd.
Good morning, Larry and Scott.
Morning.
I had a visitor in my garage the other night, a pigeon that was obviously somebody's property. It was banded.
Mm-hmm.
And after only two attempts, he let me catch it in hand, and I wrote down the band numbers and released him.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm curious, is there a resource where one can look up the band numbers and see where the bird's from?
The bands, it's my understanding that the bands used on homing pigeons, racing pigeons, and so forth are not the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service migratory bird bands that you might find on a duck or a cardinal or something like that, which are all tracked by the Bird Banding Laboratory in Patuxent, Maryland. Those you can track down very easily. The bands on pigeons are a little trickier, and if there's no indication of what club or individual it belongs to, all you can do is root around in the area. For example, in the Madison area, there's a Four Lakes Pigeon Club, and I usually steer people who have a sighting or a find like that to the club. Sometimes they find out who the owner was, sometimes not. The reality is, a couple of times when I've tried to track this down, a pigeon that ends up off in the middle of nowhere like that is not, how do I want to say this delicately, it's not a successful pigeon. It has not found its way home. It has not completed the race. Therefore, they tend to be written off by some owners. Now, having said that, the person who owns this one might be very concerned about it. So I think sometimes you can even find these things in the telephone listings. You might be able to Google it on the Internet and try and find pigeon clubs or pigeon breeders in the area. It'll take a little detective work. The short answer is there's no central repository that I'm aware of.
Yeah, there's something called the American Racing Pigeon Union. I think that may have some numbers up, but I'm not positive.
Very good. I'll give it a shot. Thank
All right. You. Thanks a lot for calling. Garrett in Oconto, your turn now. Hi, Garrett.
Good morning, Larry and Scott. Great show, by the way.
Thank you.
I have a quick question on a pair of hummingbird babies that I think may have been abandoned.
Hmm.
I'm not really sure if they have or haven't. I spent about 3 or 4 hours out last night, and they were chirping away. Their eyes looked kind of dried. They're almost full-feathered, but obviously not enough to fly yet. Is there anything I can do?
Boy, that's a tricky one. So you were lucky just to find a hummingbird nest. They're pretty small and well hidden. I'm inclined to say that the first thing to do is keep an eye on them, and if it really gets to the point where there's no question that they're in distress, you could try giving them a little bit of sugar water with an eyedropper and see if they'll respond. But if it gets to the point where it's clear the parent bird has met with some unfortunate end, about the only thing I can suggest is trying to locate a licensed wildlife rehabilitator in your area. There are lots of them scattered around the state. There's an association you could Google, but the DNR service centers also maintain lists of who the area local licensed rehabilitators are. And where were you calling from, Oconto?
Yeah.
Yeah, sir.
There are some big sanctuaries around that are kind of centers for this, too. Bay Beach and Green Bay, and there are others, too, have rehabbers and facilities on site. So you can start out with one of the big nature centers. Mosquito Hill is up in that area, Bay Beach, and see if you can hook up with a local rehabber who specializes in birds and maybe knows something about hummingbirds.
Yeah,
I'll do that. I'll watch them a little bit yet today, and then I'll go from there. But thank you very much for your help, sir.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. We have quite a few hummingbirds now coming to our feeder. Man, they're taking the sugar water right out of it every day, Scott.
I haven't had many hummingbirds yet, but holy mackerel, I'm going through a lot of grape jelly.
Oh, yeah.
Those Orioles are just about ready to clean me out.
I had this morning, we looked out at breakfast time, and there were on the one Oriole feeder, there were three Orioles fighting to get at the grape jelly, and then a couple more on the other one. So it's fun to watch, isn't it?
It is.
Jeanette in La Crosse has a question or comment for you. Hi, Jeanette.
Hi. Can you guys hear me okay?
Sure.
Yep.
Okay, great. I was calling because I have two quick questions. One is, when you find a turtle that has been run over and it's obviously really hurt, but it's still alive and still trying to maneuver, what's the best thing to do for that animal?
That's a tough one. If the shell is badly cracked, the turtle, you know, there are dramatic steps that I've seen some rehabilitators take in terms of trying to literally glue or refuse the shell. But, you know, an animal that is terminal, in your opinion, and all you can really do is make that judgment call at the time. Certainly a turtle that's got a badly cracked shell is not going to recover on its own. And, you know, I'd be torn. The decision for me would be looking at it and saying, boy, there's no hope here. And the best thing to do for the turtle is euthanize it, as opposed to trying to, you know, get it in a box and find a rehabber and let someone make the judgment who has a little more experience with it. But I think a bad shell fracture, especially if there are any organs visible that have now been subjected to, you know, potential infection and whatnot, there's not much hope.
Mm-hmm. So do you think that a person should, it sounds awful, but like if you're way out in the country, run it over a second time with your car, or what should you do?
Well, I don't think that would certainly be found in the list of humane euthanasia techniques.
No.
But the kinds of things the door slammed here behind me. The kinds of things that would be, you simply wouldn't have access to in that situation. So I'm inclined to leave that to your own creativity without speculating on how it might best be done. But, you know, if the turtle still seems reasonably lively and there's no organs visible or whatnot, again, as we just talked about with the hummingbirds, you may be able to find a nature center or an independent rehabber who would give it a shot trying to fuse the shell.
Okay. You had another question.
The other question is about last January, I happened to be outside a work building here, and I noticed that a bat had flown and it nested in the crevice outside of a door, and obviously it was January, it was real bitter cold, and he was up there and I didn't know if I should do something for him, like, you know, because it was so bitter cold, try to relocate him to something, or what would you suggest in that situation? Because I didn't know what to do, and I thought maybe he'd kind of hibernate up there or whatever they do, but then I found his body at the base a few days later. He obviously frozen. Is there something I could have done for him?
Well, yes and no. First of all, a bat really has no business out at this latitude in January, and its fate by being out of wherever it was hibernating was pretty well sealed, and the results you found. Ordinarily, our bat species are kind of split 50-50 on those that migrate out or simply stay within Wisconsin but move to what's called a hibernaculum. Might be a cave, a mine shaft, a crack in the rocks, or a church belfry, or someone's attic. And it's likely that bat, for whatever reason, perhaps during a thaw, found its way out of the attic or wherever it was, and then was disoriented, tried to find a place to hang up where it would have been fine in warmer weather, but simply perished in the cold. So not knowing, if you had known, for example, oh, yes, we have bats in the attic, or there are bats in the crawl spaces of this building, you could have carefully scooped it into a box or a container or something and reintroduced it inside where it might have had a chance. There are also folks around the state. There's a group. It's primarily a husband and a wife team in Sun Prairie who call their organization Bat Conservation of Wisconsin, Bat Cow, and they have a website, and they actually go out and do rescues and keep these bats in shelters in their home and then release them in the spring. So again, if you could get in touch with them or find someone who does the same kind of thing locally, there's a way to get that bat proper care and attention until it can take care of itself in the spring. Otherwise, you reintroduce it to its hibernaculum. I've also seen some people, with a little advice, you can sometimes overwinter them in a box in your refrigerator, but most people get a little squeamish about that. So my suggestion would be, if you ever encounter that again, check that Bat Conservation of Wisconsin website and see what they can advise about somebody in the area who can take care of it for you.
Thank you very, very much.
Yep, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. We're talking the world of wildlife today with Scott Craven, UW Extension wildlife ecologist. I'm Larry Mueller. Jim Packard, our producer here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We have many questioners for Scott Craven, UW Extension wildlife ecologist, and you could be among them at 1-800-642-1234 in Madison at 263-1890. Spence in Campbellsport is next. Hi, Spence.
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
This will maybe inspire the lady who called about the turtle. Last week, I was sitting in my backyard, and I noticed something moving in my garden here, and upon my closer inspection, there was a, I'm pretty sure it was a snapping turtle, and I was making some unusual movements in the flower garden among the marigolds, and lo and behold, it was burying some eggs. And so I watched it for a while, and it looked like it, I'd say probably 6 or 8 eggs were in that hole there. And it laboriously covered them up, and then it was on its way. I want to let nature take its course, so I'm just going to keep that area a little sectioned off here to see how long that takes to have those eggs hatch out and do whatever. But how long does that normally take? I'm pretty sure the turtle was a snapping turtle.
It probably was. That's pretty common behavior, and there could be, all told, there could be 40 or 50 or more eggs in there. If it was painted turtle, there'd only be 6, 8, 10, something like that. If they were round like little ping pong balls, it was a snapper. If they were kind of oblong, then it was some type of a pond turtle like a painted turtle. But anyway, clearing off or protecting the area may not be enough, because those nests are incredibly vulnerable to raccoons and skunks and other things that dig up the nests and eat the eggs. So if you really want to see it run its course and have the young emerge, I'd recommend maybe laying down a 3 or 4 foot square piece of chicken wire over the area where the nest is and staking that down so a mammal can't dig through it, but the little turtles will be able to pass through it with no trouble.
And how long will that take for them to hatch, do you know?
Well, it depends a little bit on how the summer goes. Usually the peak of nesting is in early June, and then emergence is usually late August, early September. So it's the better part of several months before environmental incubation gets them to hatch. The tricky part is what happens when they're ready to come out. If it's really hot and dry and the ground is caked hard, in some cases the little turtles won't emerge at all. They'll overwinter in the nest and then emerge the next spring. So it depends a little bit on weather conditions. If it gets to be 1st of September and you haven't seen any activity, you could perhaps help them out a little bit by moistening the area.
Hmm. And since the mother buries the eggs, is that the last she has to do with them? Or
that's it. Those little turtles are on their own right now. Even though they'll only be the size of from a nickel to a quarter when they hatch, they've got to get to water on their own, even though they are literally those tiny little turtles.
Wow.
And a lot of them don't make it, but enough do.
I live about 150 feet away from the Milwaukee River. I think that's the North Branch.
No problem. People find them. People find them lots further than that. Those turtles should be fine. cool. But if you happen to see them emerging, then you can certainly do them a favor and help them down to the water if you like.
Yeah,
that
sure
brings
will.
Up a question on the turtle that was crushed in the road. Most of the turtles that are out in June and July, out wandering around, are females either with eggs or that have just nested. And occasionally when someone finds a cracked or dead or near-dead turtle in the road or on the side of the road, the eggs will be obvious, and it is possible to, it is potentially possible to salvage some of those eggs and, you know, bury them 6 or 7 inches down in some warm sand and see if they have a chance of making it.
Hmm.
I'll be watching for the turtles among the marigolds.
Okay. Thanks, Benz.
Thank you.
Appreciate the call. And Fred in Watersmeet, Michigan is up next. Hi, Fred.
Hi. Couple questions I have. We're at our lakeside cabin, and a few nights ago in the middle of the night, we heard a small animal barking outside our cabin. And my question is, I wonder, can a fox bark like a small dog?
Yep.
Okay, because all the years here, we've never, you know, we have a fox that actually have some burrows on our, down by our shoreline. We haven't saw their scat this year.
Mm-hmm.
But we heard this barking like a small dog. And it went on for about 3 or 4 minutes.
It's quite possible it was your fox.
Yeah.
Okay, so I'm not crazy.
No, nope.
Not at all.
Okay, now the second question is a little controversial. My wife doesn't want me to ask it, but...
Uh-oh, okay, we're ready.
We have, I think, some starlings that are nesting along our lake shore. And what they're doing is they're keeping all the songbirds away from our feeders.
Mm-hmm.
So we don't have any chickadees. We don't have any nuthatches. The only thing that seems to come into the feeder right now is goldfinches. Mm-hmm. And we have an eagle on our lake, and the starlings even chase it. It'll be going over our head and with a starling right side by side. So the question is... can I dispatch those starlings? My wife doesn't want me to. She says they're nesting and they probably have babies. But my problem is, how long am I going to last, wait before we are able to get any songbirds at our feeders?
Well, starlings are one of only three unprotected bird species in Wisconsin. House sparrows or English sparrows, starlings, and pigeons or rock doves are unprotected. So you may do as you see fit. The question about can you dispatch them has many facets, however. One aspect is can you and then continue to be on good terms with your wife? The other, can you legally? Yes, you can, but if you're going to do anything that generally involves lethal control of any animal, even though they're unprotected, depending on the technique you're going to use, whether it's a pellet gun or a 22 or a trap or whatever, I always recommend they just run that by the local DNR conservation officer so they know what you're up to.
I was just going to sit on my front porch with my 20-gauge shotgun. But...
Well, that's certainly a technique that will work, but I'd alert your neighbors to
don't have any neighbors
before you execute it. And of course, you need to make absolutely positively sure that you're dealing with starlings. But it's routine practice to remove starlings, which are cavity nesters and compete with bluebirds and purple martins and other very desirable cavity nesters, cleaning out starling and sparrow nests and whatever else happens to be there, whether it's, you know, eggs or the adults or whatever, is fairly common management practice for those kinds of nest boxes. So you're certainly within the realm of possibility.
Okay.
Thanks a lot, guys.
Yep, thanks, Fred, for calling. Bob in Darlington, your turn. Hi, Bob.
Yeah, morning, Larry. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Yeah, I think in a short while, my wife and I were going to move closer to my son up in Rhinelander.
Uh-huh.
And he's got a nice cabin on Long Lake.
Yeah.
The little lake between Sugar Camp and Eagle River.
No, the lake.
And then he has a nice cabin on Lake Columbus. And these two lakes are quite close together. You probably know that, Scott, huh?
Mm-hmm.
And I was just wondering, I've been fishing with my son and my grandson for many years on both those lakes. And I was just wondering the length limit on walleye pike in Long Lake and Columbus?
Well, I have no idea off the top. I'm going to say it's probably 15 inches, which is standard up here.
That's a terrible length, and I'll tell you why, Scott.
Well,
you know, a lot of walleyes in Lake, especially Lake Columbus.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, my grandson measures them to make sure that they're legal.
Mm-hmm.
And you're right. You're right. I think they had to be 15 inches.
Mm-hmm.
But
most of them are 14 and a half.
Well, then I tell my grandson to get a pliers and we'll pull from both ends, right?
Uh-huh.
No, don't do that.
No, I don't do that. I'm just teasing. But what I'm wondering is that, you know, especially on Lake Columbus, real round-bellied walleyes, and it looks like they're really ready for the frying pan, they're about 13 and a half inches. And so I say, darn. And my grandson, I ask him, I say, well, Brett, how long is that walleye? Pretty close to 15, wasn't it? He said, "Yeah, well, Grandpa, close for the DNR isn't close enough. You have to have 15 inches."
That's right.
So back it goes. And some of these, you know, they really swallow the bait and are kind of ruined. And then we might be moving around, and then we move back and hear the fish is laying their belly up.
Mm-hmm.
And then I sort of, you know, what comes to my head right away is, "Gee, I wish I could have cleaned him and stuck him in the frying pan."
Right.
And I know what you're going to say. You're going to say, let the eagles come down, swoop down, and pick them up, right?
Well, you just don't have any choice, because an illegal walleye is an illegal walleye, and there's just going to be no sympathy there. Some of them do get deeply hooked or damaged and do die, and it's unfortunate, and I know there's a lot of frustration over any size limits, but particularly the walleye size limit, because sometimes you get on a lake where it just seems like you can't get a fish over 14 and 7/8 inches.
And yeah.
Just before I got the phone call here at Kemp, I was talking to the fellow who takes care of the physical plant here, and he talked about a lake he and his brother were fishing on, not right in the local area here, and I think they caught, I thought he said 40-some walleyes in a day or evening's fishing, and not one of them hit 15 inches. And he was very frustrated, but the pressure on that fishery is really pretty amazing in some lakes up here, and once those fish do hit the legal size, they get
caught.
They get caught out of the population pretty quickly. So there's a good reason for the limit in terms of distributing the resource and protecting spawning age fish and so forth. So I share your frustration, but a legal fish is a legal fish, and an illegal fish is just that.
Is just that. And and you know, the thing about walleye is that, unlike with bass and muskie, where you have a lot of catch and release, there's on a legal walleye, seems like nobody wants to release that fish.
Yeah, the good news is, I guess, on the really big ones do seem to get released, because
right.
I think the party line is that, you know, once they're over 25 inches or so, they're not that great eating, but certainly anything in the 15 to 19 or 20-inch class, I don't think very many of those see the water again if they end up in a boat.
No, I think you're right. Well, Bob, good luck to getting some 15-plus-inch walleyes. Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate it. Oh, boy. Louise in Hillsborough is up next. Let's go to Louise. Hi, Louise.
Yes, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Since the flooding in Vernon County, we had a bridge across Warner Creek down there, and there's quite a bit of debris deposited on it and next to it. And we have quite a few, suddenly have quite a few snakes there.
Mm-hmm.
And it wouldn't bother me so much, but I'm a little concerned because my dogs keep getting in confrontations with them.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just wondering if, it's hard for me to identify what kind of snake. And they have a brownish pattern. They're not huge, but they have a brownish pattern, and I think, except when I see them, they're usually getting ready to strike or try to strike the dog. I thought I saw kind of a reddish stripe, but I'm not certain, and I don't know if you have any idea what they might be.
Well, the most likely snakes in that area to be found around water, and especially around debris where flooding remains, and it's an aggressive snake, would be the northern banded water snake, or just basically water snake. And I think if you have access to the internet, if you Google water snake, or go on the DNR website to the Bureau of Endangered Resources and link to their snake identification booklet, which you can also get from any DNR office. There are excellent colored photos of all 22 species of Wisconsin snakes. But a brown pattern near the water, an aggressive, readily and willing to strike, sounds like a banded water snake to me. And although they're aggressive, they're harmless in the sense of being non-venomous. It's highly unlikely that they're a venomous species. We only have two. One of them is very rare, and the other one, the larger timber rattlesnake, I think you'd be able to identify as a rattlesnake. They wouldn't be in that kind of environment anyway. So whether they're banded water snakes or possibly some of the other brown patterned snakes like milk snakes or fox snakes, I can't tell you for sure without seeing it, but it sounds like the water snake, and they're really not going to cause any problem to the dog. And even if one gives him a little nip on the nose, it's no worse than being scratched by a cat, and it shouldn't really be a big issue.
Oh, that's good to know. Thank you so much.
Anyway, any snakes, the only two venomous snakes in Wisconsin, first of all, they do both have a blotched pattern, but they're pretty heavy-bodied snakes. They can be quite large, and the most distinctive thing you'll see is a big wedge-shaped head. They have a very distinctive head, whereas all of our non-venomous snakes, the head is basically just a continuation of the body, but not distinctively larger or bulging. So there's a distinct neck behind the head on the venomous snakes, but I really don't think there's very much chance that that's what you're dealing with.
No. Thanks, Louise.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Diane in Watertown, we'll turn to you now. Hi, Diane.
Good morning. I was just wondering, my daughter, who is a total nature freak, found a baby bird in a little bitty bottom of a pine tree and took quite a few photos of it. It wasn't afraid at all of her, but we're having a hard time identifying what it is, and I tried to look online and I couldn't. Do you have any good sources where we could look?
Baby birds are really tricky because until they have their adult feathers or even mature feathers, they can be just little nondescript fuzzballs.
Yeah.
And even
that's
some
what we're running one, up. It did have a black stripe on its head and white around the black. If that helps.
Well, a little, but without, you know, without some size comparison and so forth, that's really tough. And some young birds, even when they get feathers and are flying, until they have their first molt into adult plumage, they don't even look like the adults. A juvenile starling, for example, looks very little like an adult starling, even when they're flying around. So that's really a tough call. But there are some terrific bird websites. If you were on the Internet, I'm not sure what sites you checked, but if you start out with a site called eBird, just eBird, and then there's a Wisconsin version and the national site, there are links to all sorts of identification there. And if you get into the information about a given, you know, pick some common birds, if it was small and had a black stripe, you know, the chickadees, some of the sparrows, I'm just speculating, but start with some of the common birds you see in your area and see if there are any images or descriptions of what the juveniles look like.
Yep.
Okay, thank
you. Otherwise, if you've got the pictures, then you could always email an electronic file to either some of the DNR folks or to me or whatever, and we'd have a look at it.
Yeah.
Well, who would we do that with?
Well, you could send it to me, and we could try and get an identification. I know lots of better birders than I am who could take a look at it, but it's just srcraven@wisc.edu.
Okay.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thanks a lot for calling. And we'll turn to Pat in Gray Lake, Illinois next. Hi, Pat.
Hello, Gray Lake, Illinois. And what I am curious about is I saw some immature sandhill cranes going across a cornfield in Gray Lake last week, and I just thought that was so unusual.
Not unusual at all. First of all, cranes love cornfields, and secondly, the breeding population of cranes all over Wisconsin and spilling down into northern Illinois has been doing very, very well. So cranes have become a pretty darn common sight throughout most of Wisconsin, and I assume, as I said, parts of northern Illinois.
Oh, okay, because I hadn't seen any other than, like I said, closer to Wisconsin, and all of a sudden I saw them there, and then I saw them in Wadsworth, and I also saw them in Bristol. So I don't know if it's the same pair or not, but...
Pretty neat.
Wherever there's a wetland, there are going to be cranes these days, and they're the bane of existence for some farmers who are, when they're out in the cornfield, especially as the corn is smaller, pulling the seedlings to get the seed kernel. But later on, after harvest, they're just in the fields for unharvested grain or whatever, snakes or frogs or whatever they can find out there.
Oh, okay. Well, very interesting. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks for calling, Pat. Bernie in Berglund, Michigan is our next caller. Hi, Bernie.
Hi there.
What can we do for you?
Well, first of all, thanks for the show and thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I've got a mystery. I'm here on Lake Ogibek, which is more or less in the middle of nowhere. I have fox and raccoon in the yard regularly. We know there's a bear that's been hanging around. We did have a skunk, but he's gone now. And the mystery is, what kind of critter might be digging up fertilizer spikes that my husband pounded in around some evergreens? The animal dug it up one night. My husband replanted the spike, put a rock over it, and the animal still came, dug it up, and hauled it off. So what would be interested in fertilizer spikes, and what would they be doing with it?
Hmm. John, your neighbor.
The neighbors are pretty few and far between.
So these are like those Job spikes,
yeah,
about 4 or 5 inches long and as big around as your thumb.
They're a little bit bigger around than that.
Oh, they're pretty substantial. So it's not likely a chipmunk or a ground squirrel or something like that.
No.
So I'm thinking that the most likely culprits are something that's smelling them and routinely digs up grubs and turtle nests and things like that, and then has the strength or ability to lug it away until they realize the error in their ways, and then I would think they would abandon it. But the stuff has a pretty good aroma to it, and at first glance to a raccoon or skunk or other animal that does that kind of thing, they might get the idea, whoa, this might be good to eat, and then later change their mind. But by then your fertilizer spike is gone. But I'm thinking most likely raccoons or skunks.
Okay. Thanks very much. I hope they don't eat it.
Thanks a lot for calling. Stick a couple of mouse traps out there on top of it, Seth.
Well, the other way for a lot of these mysteries, and I've had a couple by email in the last week or so, really baffling things, plants disappearing and whatnot. The technique that a lot of people are turning to is to set up one of these trail cameras, motion-sensitive cameras that are pretty inexpensive now on the low-end models, and enough people have them, you can probably borrow one, and set that up on the site, and all of a sudden you get a photograph of the culprit and know exactly what's going on.
Yeah, that's a lot of fun.
On the fertilizer spikes, if they're doing it routinely rather than put a rock down, I'd do the same thing I mentioned for the turtle nest.
Yeah.
Let's just take a square of chicken wire or hardware cloth and stake that down over the fertilizer spike, and there's no way they can get to it.
No way.
Great. Thanks much.
Yep. Yeah, thanks, Bernie. Thanks for calling. Scott Craven, UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist, our guest today. I'm Larry Mueller. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. If you have a wildlife question, I hope you'll join us as we visit with Scott Craven. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. In Madison, 263-1890. Kelly in Milwaukee has a question for you, Scott. Kelly, hi. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Scott and Larry. I have a question about chipmunks. My mom has a cement stoop, and there's a chipmunk, and there are a couple holes in it, and a chipmunk's been kind of going in and out for the last couple of years, and she would like my husband to patch the holes, but I said, well, you know, it might have babies in there, or it might be in there when you patch it, so I'm just wondering what the best time would be to do that.
What do you think, Scott?
Well, probably now would be okay. They could be between litters, but the very early spring, before there's a litter,
okay,
or probably after the 1st of September, you'd be relatively safe in doing it. You could, I think, using hardware cloth or a small frame, it depends on the kind of access hole the chipmunk has, manufacture a little one-way door device that would allow the animal to vacate but then not get back in.
Mm-hmm.
And once that had been in place for a day or so you were fairly sure the animal was out, then you could go ahead and make the repairs. That wouldn't help if there are young in there, but that, you know, again, that's sort of a crapshoot in a way to not know for sure whether there are young in there or not. But again, early in the spring, late in the summer, or maybe mid-season about now, before they have a second litter, you should be okay.
We could certainly wait. There's no hurry. It's been like that for a while.
I'd be tempted to give it until into September.
Okay.
And then try the one-way door to avoid trapping the individual in there. The other option, depending on the substrate around the hole, is to just either kind of rake out or brush out the dirt, or sprinkle some flour or talcum powder down there when there's a couple dry days expected, and then you can tell from the animal's tracks when it has left.
Okay. Well, now what about hibernation? Do they hibernate
They probably will in that in that hole, but that won't occur until probably October or November.
So if we could get it in late September, that would be after the litters and before the hibernation.
Correct.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. All right.
Thanks a lot.
Yeah, thanks, Kelly, for calling. Kim and Hilbert, you are up. Hi, Kim.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
A few years ago, I saw two coyotes fighting, and one actually killed the other one. I think there were pups involved because that evening we could hear some yiping, but I was wondering what would have caused this. Would it have been another female, or would it have been a male?
Hmm.
Well, members of the dog family don't get along well with each other, and they're also pretty territorial, so the more likely explanation was a wandering coyote, potentially of either sex, that moved into an area where a pair had a litter, or there was a pack, so to speak, an extended family, and the squabble ensued. But it also takes place between members of the dog family, too. A coyote won't tolerate a fox around very easily, the same way a wolf won't tolerate a coyote around, and they'll do everything they can to kill them. The larger one usually winning out. But within the species, same thing with wolves. When a stranger wanders into a pack's territory, or in the case of the coyote, same situation.
Okay.
So it's an unusual thing to witness, but it does happen.
Yeah, I felt kind of privileged, and yet it was kind of sad at the same time.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Okay, well, thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Kim. Very unusual to be able to witness that. Fern in Whitehall, your turn. Hi, Fern.
Hello. I found a little tiny toad that had a creature clinging to it that was about four times as big as the toad. And it was black and shiny and almost fish-shaped, but I couldn't see any eyes on it.
It was probably a leech.
Oh, it was big. Are they big?
Well, if it was a small toad, I mean, you could certainly find a pond leech that would be as big as your index finger.
Oh, he's much bigger than that. And I didn't know what to do. If I left it, the toad would die. I was sure of that. So
this was out. This was not in the water.
No, it was in my garden. I pulled him apart as fast as I could. The toad fainted, but he came to again and hopped away. And
what became of this black thing?
It had ugly teeth, wedge-shaped teeth. And a piece of the skin of the toad was gone. And
was this thing furry?
No, it was. It had skin that reminded me of a catfish.
Sounds like a leech of some sort.
Oh,
well, a leech wouldn't have teeth.
No, it wouldn't. That's
have
right.
Have a suction disc, but. Holy cow, I can't think of much else. Leech was the first thing that came to mind because you'll find those attached to turtles and other such things. There are certainly some dark-colored small mammals that might attack a toad, like some of the larger shrews, but unless it was wet and therefore gave you the appearance that it, but there was no distinct head or anything like that.
It just seemed to be tapered from head to tail. I couldn't tell where one ended and
huh.
And it had teeth, big mouth with a lot of teeth that were like wedges fitted together.
Well, that sounds like the mouth of a shrew, Larry. And some of the larger shrews could be that size. A water shrew could be that size relative to a toad. They'd have sharp teeth, and maybe if it was wet, you might get the impression that it was tapered from end to end. But short of a leech or some small mammal, I can think of no other pond creature or whatnot, and no fish certainly that I can think of that would have. Was this anywhere near water at all?
Well, the creek is about a block and a half away.
So a toad, a small toad, couldn't drag something that size all the way from the water. So.
I wouldn't think so. He was so tiny.
Hmm.
And this thing was so ugly.
Shrew. Did
you observe what happened after the toad hopped away? What did the thing do?
I stomped on it.
You stomped on it. Okay, well, I guess we're going to have to put this one in the column. Don't know, Larry. And short of a photograph or whatnot, I'm not sure we'll ever know.
All right. Thank you.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Shrew might be a good guess. I don't know. Charlie in Twin Lakes, your turn. Hi, Charlie.
Hi there. You were talking before about turtles, and you were saying when they're born, they're the size of a nickel to a quarter. And some of these you see coming are so huge on the road. I was just wondering how old they grow to be.
Oh boy, we've had over the years. I've had reports of people who have had in the old days. Well, old days. I think when I was a kid, for example, every hardware store had a shallow pool filled with little turtles that kids would buy and take home and have a little plastic dish with a fake palm tree in it, and the turtle would crawl around and. Or they'd find baby turtles in the wild or win them at the fair. But I've had reports over the years of people finding or having these things in the basement. I had one within the last few years where the people called said that they had gotten this turtle in the 1940s and still had it in a tank. This was 6 or 7 years ago. Still had the turtle 40, 50, 60 years later. In the wild, of course, they can have all sorts of things go haywire and between highway traffic and predators and assorted other things. But still, the longevity of those really large snapping turtles that people are seeing out, 15, 20, 25, 30, 35, 40, no problem. So, the bottom line is they can achieve great longevity.
All right. Jeff and Seymour, your turn now. Hi, Jeff.
Hi. I have a question on muskrats. We have some hunting land, and it's real mucky. There's a pond and dikes all over, and they dig way underneath, and then the land collapses.
Yep.
And I was wondering, is there a way short of trapping to eradicate them?
No. Well, there's two possibilities. The idea of these bank burrows subsiding and causing problems with the land subsiding, or worse yet, the animals penetrate a dike or water control structure, and then it drains your pond or marsh or whatever. In fact, it was just in the news last week that muskrats were being blamed for one of the levee collapses down along the Mississippi, where there'd been so much tunneling and whatnot in the levee that it was weakened to the subsequent floodwaters. But the one approach is to deal with the muskrats directly. By trapping and removal, and you may find a local trapper who's willing to come in and do that just for the pelts. The other approach is where the water control structure or dike or ditch or whatever is sensitive to leakage. There are different types of riprap that can be put down, even galvanized wire, but also rock. It can be a major construction project, mind you, using either a rubber membrane that's trenched into the dike or some type of wire riprap or rock riprap that's placed on the slope, extending a foot or two up above the water line and a foot or two below the water line so the rats can't burrow into it or don't want to. So it's either a mechanical fix to prevent leakage or water loss, or it's a matter of reducing the muskrat population. But if your question was, can they be shot or poisoned or something like that more efficiently, no, they can't be taken that way.
Okay, so trapping would be the only legal method.
Would be the preferred alternative, and again, there may be people more than willing to help out. You might want to direct that question also to one of the USDA Wildlife Services officers to see what kind of recommendations or whether it's possible that in a damaged situation there might be some permit granted to authorize other than what I just described.
Okay.
All right.
Okay, let's go check that out then.
All righty.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks very much for calling.
Larry, this the turtle issue that came up with longevity again. I was just trying to think of. Never mind. We'll come back to that again.
We'll come back to
the question of long-lived turtles. We'll probably come back to.
Scott Craven, UW Extension wildlife ecologist, our guest here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're taking a look at the world of wildlife today with Scott Craven, UW Extension wildlife ecologist, Larry Mueller here, and really happy to have you listening in. If you have a question, feel free to join us at 800-642-1234 in Madison at 263-1890. And Scott, lots of callers online, so let's go to the phones here and to Mary in Green Bay. Hello, Mary.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm calling about a baby cardinal that we had in our yard in a bush. A storm like tore apart the bush, and we found the nest. We saw the nest in there. And about a week after the egg hatched, the baby bird was out of its nest, hopping on branches, and its parents were trying to, like, the parent cardinals were trying to get it back in the nest, and then, but it wasn't. It was like hopping from branch to branch, and it didn't look old enough to fly yet. But the next day, both the parents and the baby cardinal were gone. And I was wondering if you knew what might have happened.
No, I really don't. You know, they may have simply moved off. If the young bird was mobile and reluctant to get back in the nest, it may have, as you said, it was hopping around. It may have hopped off or flapped off to a point where the parents stayed with it to attempt to take care of it. I guess that's the optimal outcome, so that's what we'll try and believe. On the other hand, the outcome may have been less favorable, and during the night a passing coon, possum, skunk, whatever, dispatched the young, and then with no young to keep the parents close to a nest site or the young, they moved off to consider re-nesting or doing whatever else the adult cardinals were going to do. So let's go with the former hypothesis and assume that the young bird hopped off. Maybe it was a little older than perhaps you thought, or a little more capable, and the adult simply stayed with it to keep it fed, and they're all now doing just fine.
Okay.
The bottom line is there's absolutely no way to tell. Without some remains or some obvious circumstances, there's simply no way to tell.
Yeah.
Okay.
Thanks,
Thank
Mary.
You.
Yeah, thanks, Mary, for calling. Roy in Marshfield, you're up. Hi, Roy.
How are you guys?
Great.
We're good. Hey, I agree with your opinion of Scott and your program. I love listening to it. Anyway, for the last couple of years, I've been getting what I think are bird droppings in my driveway. It's concrete, southern exposure, but they only show up at night. And they look like real thin brown spaghetti with a white blotch on them. And they're clumps about the size of, oh, maybe a pecan nut.
Do you live near water?
Oh, well, there's a creek that, probably 3-4 blocks from me, but it's not much of a water source.
Okay. What do you think, Scott?
Oh, boy, and there are a lot of these?
No, there's only one or two every morning. Well, not every, and not even every morning. Maybe a couple times a week in the summertime. First, I thought they might be toad droppings, but it's been so dry around here that I haven't seen a toad around here, because I've seen big toad droppings that had.
Yeah, well, that's one of the things that amazes people. Once they finally realize what size dropping a toad or something like that actually leaves, it's pretty amazing. So that's a possibility, but if you're suspecting bird, there are two. We've talked about a couple of guides to field sign before. They're both by an author named Mark Elbrock, E-L-B-R-O-C-H. And there's one about mammals. It's called Mammal Tracks and Sign, and there's a companion one called Bird Tracks and Sign. And on the sign part, there's a whole series of really well-done colored photographs of all the various types of droppings, as well as tracks and other types of sign, but a really nice section on droppings that are left behind, particularly in the bird section. Now, generally, bird droppings are pretty structureless and hard to interpret. And I'm not at all certain that what you're seeing is a bird. You know, you mentioned toads. There are other possibilities. If there's a mass of stuff left behind, then it probably is something other than the kind of long, skinny slime trails I find that are the activity of slugs and some other nighttime creatures on my own sidewalks and driveways. But I can't.
Oh, yeah, that's not.
I simply don't know and would be going through the illustrations myself, but if you can ever find one that you get a picture of, again, an image is a lot easier for us to work from. But I would next time you're in a big bookstore, look for those two books by Elbrock, and I think if you just thumb through the dropping section, you can rule in or rule out birds pretty easily.
Well, I found it kind of interesting that they're brown, except they got the bird signature white,
right,
end, yeah, on one, or white whatever on one end, and that's why I thought it might be a.
But you know, it sounds like they're large enough for some bird that might just be wandering through there in the night to leave an occasional calling card, and so it doesn't look anything like, say, a grouse or a turkey dropping or something like that.
The dropping is real structured, as if you took some real fine spaghetti, mm-hmm, and
yep,
made it into a ball.
You got us stumped on that. Well, take a picture of it, and
yep, next time you find one, send a picture into the station, and we'll figure it out or find somebody who can.
Yep, we can do that. Thank you very much, Roy, for calling. Appreciate it. Nick in Avalon, it's your turn. Hi, Nick.
Hi.
What can we do for you?
I have a question about a pie-billed grebe.
Okay.
How common are they?
Well, that's kind of a tough question. In good habitat, in the kind of marshy wetlands and shallow ponds and so forth where you'd expect to see grebes, they're not uncommon. I hate to word it that way. It's not like there are a lot of them around, and unless you're in their specific habitat, you wouldn't see one at all. But again, if you're in a good-sized wetland or visiting a place like Horican Marsh or something like that, then I think it's quite possible you would see a pie-billed grebe if you were out bird watching.
And probably, just according to eBird, in Wisconsin, you're going to most likely see them in April, May, and that time of the year.
Yeah, earlier than now. But they're, if you're asking the question, you probably know what they look like. So if they were around and you saw one, you'd know what you're seeing. But again, if you go to the right habitat and the right migration period, you'll likely find one.
Okay.
Because we live near Rock Prairie.
Mm-hmm.
After the storm, we found it under our van.
Oh, you found a pie-billed grebe?
Found one under the van after those heavy rains?
Yes.
Huh. Well, that's interesting. You see, that's probably a case where the bird may have been. Was it dead or alive?
It was alive.
Was alive. And what was its fate? What did you do with it?
We just put it in a cage, and then we took it to, like, a hospital or something because his...
Okay, so you found someone who could take care of it.
Yes.
Well, that's a case where, incidental to a storm, which can, you know, blow birds off course by hundreds of miles or knock birds down or put them in strange places, like under someone's van... That kind of circumstance has relatively little to do with their normal distribution or abundance. So, you know, finding some accident like that could have been just about any species, but you certainly did the right thing trying to get it to someone, a rehabilitator or whoever, who could take care of it and ultimately release it. So hopefully it's been released and it's on its way again.
Yeah. You did the right thing.
You did the right thing.
Thanks, Nick.
You're welcome.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. Scott, somebody called in and said that toad with the growth on it was maybe a juvenile lamprey, but, you know, that was pretty far away from water.
You know, it seemed like it, and she described it as such a tiny little toad that it's hard to imagine a small toad with a juvenile lamprey or a brook lamprey or something like that attached to it would have. I mean, I can understand her description, tapered from end to end, and a fearsome-looking mouth would certainly be a reasonable depiction of a lamprey.
Yeah, it sure would. Sean in Helenville, you're up. Thank you for calling.
Well, thank you for taking my call. Appreciate it.
Sure.
Got a couple sandhill cranes down from my house. They have a couple little ones with them. They tend to loiter on a road that runs in between the marsh down from my house, as I said. But I'm noticing when I go by in my vehicle, that being I have an SUV, they run, they stay away. When I drive by in my Harley, the male will, and now mind you, I'm getting to within about 60 feet or more. Uh-huh. The male tends to go away, but the mother, now she comes after me. Hmm. Only when I'm on my motorcycle, on my SUV, and when I see other cars go by, they will exit in a hurry. But on the motorcycle, she has come at me, and I guess my question is, I try not to get any closer than 40, 30 feet or so, and would she attack?
She must be a Honda fan or some other brand.
I believe she is.
You know, I'm guessing that it's something to do with the frequency of the sound that the motorcycle creates that has that bird agitated. And there are certain sounds made by human machinery that birds respond very strangely to.
Sure.
I remember working with Canada geese. It was a helicopter rotor. I mean, you wouldn't even know there was a helicopter around. All the geese would take off, and then all of a sudden, a helicopter would appear. They just—they just hated that rotor sound and the vibration it created. And there's probably something about the motorcycle that has that female agitated. Who knows what? If the real concern—I mean, you're able to stay away and avoid her to avoid any harm to the crane. But if your concern is, gee, could she get close enough where that bill could that bill could do a little damage?
Yeah.
I don't think that's a very serious risk. You're probably more mobile on the motorcycle than she is. And although birds or even mammals will occasionally bluff charge or look threatening or make a display, the notion that they're really going to come right up and make physical contact doesn't happen very often.
Sure.
This is sort of an unusual circumstance, so I can't rule out any possibility, but I think both you and the crane are probably okay, given your ability to stay out of harm's way.
Okay.
Yeah, she kind of boxed me in the second time. We've had two encounters now. One time, the first encounter I had with her, I didn't know why she came at me. And I'm like, then I seen the little ones. I'm like, oh, now it was quite apparent as to why she did. And now the second time, which was a couple weekends ago, she literally had me boxed in because I couldn't get around her, and she literally was marching, and she would put her neck down in this real weird kind of a way.
Yeah, threatening posture.
Yeah, she would march across the road, and then if I got closer to get around her, so I was kind of going down a hill, so I couldn't really back up too well. Mm-hmm. And she kept a close distance to me, and then she kind of put her wings out and came at me, and then finally a car came by, and they took off, and so then...
Oh, man.
Well, while she's got those chicks, you might consider an alternate route, and at the very least, I'd get a good helmet with a visor on it.
Very good, very good. Well, thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks, Sean. Thanks a lot for calling. Todd in Dodgeville, it's your turn. Hi, Todd.
Hey, guys. How you doing?
Good.
Great.
Good. Thanks for taking my call. I'm on a cell phone, so I'll give you my question, and then I'll hang up here. But... anyway, I just moved into the Dodgeville area, and I live down outside of town, and I live in kind of a valley amongst a rock cropping. There's quite a few rock croppings, and I have like a prairie with a pond and a little marshy area. Well, anyway, we were told on our home inspection that we do have timber rattlers in the area, and it's like a perfect habitat for them.
That's just what they like.
So we had quite a bit of, I've seen quite a bit of gardener snakes around, which the black, which I'm fine with. But my wife did spot a smaller timber rattler, probably about 2 feet long, as she was walking down the road. My question is, I have two small kids. I guess I'd like to know about their breeding habitats, the safety, and, you know, just kind of a general overview about them. And I'll hang up and I'll take the answer. Thanks a lot, guys.
Yep.
Well, you know, in general, the kind of rocky outcropping habitat along or in southwestern Wisconsin, you know, anywhere near the Wisconsin River Valley is prime timber rattlesnake habitat, but they're not especially abundant, even in good habitat. They, a few years ago, declared a protected species, a protected wild animal in Wisconsin, because of the fact that they weren't all that abundant. And you know, there are plenty of people in southwestern Wisconsin. There are some rattlesnakes, and we just don't hear very much about encounters that end poorly with someone being bitten. It can happen, and it certainly is a potentially dangerous situation. But I think, Larry, and for the caller, what happens is people learn enough about the snakes to know when they're out and you know what danger they really pose, and they teach their kids about it, and the snakes and the people are able to coexist comfortably, you know, maybe with a little apprehension, but coexistence is possible. There's no reason to indiscriminately kill the snakes, and that's now illegal. And the snakes are not interested in they're interested in staying out of harm's way with people. Typically, they would move to a suitable cave or a rock outcropping where they would hibernate for the winter, emerge in, depending on the spring, you know, early to mid-spring, perhaps sometime in April. The females usually hang around the den site for a while. They are live bearers, so they hang around in the sun, and the warmth helps get the eggs ready to hatch internally. The males disperse around the countryside, and then after birth of the young, the females do as well. And during midsummer, they could be found anywhere in the kind of prairie habitat he describes, or basking on a roadside or by an old stump or rock or something like that. And then toward fall, they all return to the hibernaculum and spend the winter again. That's the long and short of the annual cycle. I guess all I can say is it would behoove the caller to get a little rattlesnake information. There are some good educational pieces available. The DNR has cooperated in rare snake workshops along the Mississippi and Wisconsin River corridors in recent years, educating landowners about the snakes and how to avoid anything unpleasant with them. And I think that information, again, could be gleaned from the DNR website under the Bureau of Endangered Resources. And there's also some timber rattler information there in terms of identification and their habits. So, you know, basically they're out there, but in most places where there are venomous snakes, even parts of the world where there are a lot more and more dangerous venomous snakes than we have, places like Australia, people who live in those areas simply learn about the snakes and their habits, and things seem to come out okay.
All right. Thanks again for calling. Lisa in Madison, your turn. Let's see. We get Lisa on here. For some reason, I can't get her on. Let's see. Lisa, are you there? Oh, we lost Lisa. Let's try it again. Oh, let's see. There we go. No, we lost Lisa. Let's try Julie in Washburn. Julie, are you there? Oh, we're having a little problem here, Scott.
Well, that's all right. I thought of what I wanted to say about those turtles earlier in terms of living a long time. The interesting thing about it is, how does a turtle like that, which seems like a pretty simple animal, achieve longevity comparable to a human? And that besides life in the slow lane, which helps them out a little bit, the interesting thing is they have no teeth. And for most wild animals, the ultimate wearing out or loss of their teeth are what does them in. Turtles don't have to worry about that. And in addition, their bones grow continuously, so they never really stop growing. So continuous growth and no teeth are what point them in the right direction.
We have some kind of optimistic news regarding our grouse population in the state, Scott.
Yep, good news again. For about the third consecutive year, the grouse spring grouse drumming counts were up again. you know, not dramatically, but enough to be significant. And the bottom line is there's expectation again for this fall. There's a lot of enthusiasm for another great grouse hunting season, and we should still have a year or two on the upswing before we reach a seasonal peak, maybe next year or the year after.
Mm-hmm. And I mentioned at the start of the program about the spring turkey harvest. That set a record again. All the numbers are in. What was it,
53,000, I think, something like that.
53,000.
Yeah, about 53,000 birds harvested. It was another fantastic spring. Turkey hunting's become a huge event in Wisconsin, and we can only hope the related story, of course, was the giant fiasco surrounding the sale of the extra turkey permits. It's my understanding that it has yet to be resolved. A report is forthcoming, but I know a team of DNR people traveled down to Missouri to the computer contractor who handles that sale, and they're exploring every conceivable option to make sure that doesn't happen again. And I, for one, certainly hope they figure it out, because it was a nightmare trying to get a permit.
Well, I tell you what, there was another story about an eagle that died near Saner this year that had been banded 30 years ago.
Mm-hmm. Yep, that was not very far from where I sit right now, and it was an interesting story, kind of pointing to the longevity of wildlife like we were talking about with the turtles. Some of these larger birds, some of the turtles, and even some animals you don't expect to live a long time, like the caller who was worried about finding the dead bat earlier. Even bats have a longevity of 10, 12, 14 years, maybe even as much as 20. So it kind of spans a wide variety of wildlife, from small mammals through larger birds and animals like turtles you wouldn't expect to be successful for that long.
Yeah, that's for sure. Well, Scott, I tell you what, we're just about out of time here. Anything on the end here as we go into the 4th of July weekend in the way of wildlife that you want to pass on to people?
Well, a couple things to just say. At least in my case, my garden is finally beginning to produce after all the work to get it into shape, and I would urge people to take precautions up front, to utilize a fence or some other tactics to avoid very frustrating problems, or what can be very frustrating problems, with rabbits and deer and other garden pests. Generally, by the time we get into August, most people have so much extra produce that they don't mind sharing a little bit. But those first ears of corn or the first tomatoes or the first beans are highly prized, especially with prices the way they're going. So take some steps to protect your gardens from those animals that are interested in the same thing. And as we approach a holiday weekend here, I just say get out and enjoy seeing all the great stuff that's out there in terms of birds, mammals, reptiles, and amphibians, all sorts of things going on, and get out and enjoy them.
Yeah. Scott, thanks so much. Really
no
appreciate
problem.
It. We'll talk to you again the first Wednesday of next month.
Yes, we will do that.
All right. Scott Craven, UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist, our guest, and always a pleasure. He'll be back the first Wednesday of the month. And he mentioned food prices, and you know, coming up tomorrow at 11, we'll be talking about eating well while money is tight. And that's certainly, I think, a timely topic. Sue Nitzke, a UW Extension nutritional scientist, will be with us, as will Gail Coleman, who is also with UW Extension. She's a nutritionist as well. So we'll look forward to hearing what they have to say about eating well while that money's tight. In the meantime, thanks for listening. Stay with us. Many more good things in store here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.